Thank you. I'm Patty. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
I'm a real alcoholic. I bring a bottle with me. I don't understand glasses. I've never understood a glass. Just way too much work for me. I'm grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a little concerned. I noticed you didn't pass out evaluations last night when Lila talked. But I'm really happy to, I need to correct Valerie. I've had the privilege of working in treatment for 22 years. I have never been a counselor. I want you to know that I have never damaged anybody who has come into treatment. I have had the good fortune of starting at the top. I've directed programs for 22 years. I've never been a counselor, and I'm grateful for that. I've always believed if you're going to start somewhere, it should be the top. I'm really happy to be here with, there's people in this room who were gratefully in Alcoholics Anonymous when I arrived. Tony, who was Tony Creedon then, I understand she's had several transformations over the last 27 years, trying to find a last name that she likes. Joanne and Chuck, who were pillars in Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California 27 years ago, and I am so grateful that the two of them understood the traditions and lived by the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it was through the people who were here when I came in who knew the traditions and who lived by those principles that I was allowed to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Doris and Bob, Doris was angry 27 years ago. Doris was a knitter. I don't know if she still knits. I was checking around. I noticed she didn't have any knitting needles on her today. But Doris used to knit, and you knew when Doris was angry. So it was like there's always this clickety-click, clickety-click, clickety-click from Doris's section. And I was one of those alcoholics that came in and left. If they're going to make me learn how to knit, I'm not staying here. And this hideous clickety-click, clickety-click coming from Doris, but you could tell when Doris was getting upset because the clickety-click would get, like, faster. Clickety-click-click-click-click-click-click. I mean, really fast. It sounded like one click there for a while. And my whole purpose in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous when Doris was there was to see if I could get her knitting fast enough to ignite the yarn. And the other thing Doris used to do, if you, not that she was judgmental, I don't want to take Doris's inventory, but not that she was judgmental at all, but if you were in a participation meeting with Doris and you were sharing and you kind of went on and on and on and on, all of a sudden you'd see this from Doris. There'd be this watch. And it always fascinated me because she could wave her watch and knit at the same time. And I am so grateful to those three women and countless other members of Alcoholics Anonymous who came here and stayed so that Alcoholics Anonymous was here when I arrived. I want to thank you for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to participate in my recovery. I've been having a good time since I arrived here. I've had a great time right up until about this moment. And I'm sure I'll have fun as soon as this is over. My sponsor always tells me when I do this, I should tell you my name and tell you the truth. I've already told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but that makes sense to me because I never knew when I was out there, I didn't know that what it used to be like was going to be important. When I was out there, if I would have known I was going to be here this morning reporting to you what it used to be like, I would have paid more attention to my life. If I would have known, I'm very anal, I'd have taken notes. If I would have known what it used to be like was going to be, if I would have known about steps 4 and 5, I can guarantee you I would not have done some of the things that I did. But I didn't know it was going to be important, so I didn't pay a lot of attention. Coupled with that, I'm a blackout drinker. If you're a blackout drinker, what it used to be like gets a little shady. Kind of have to rely on people to report to me what it used to be like. I love blackouts, by the way. I don't know if there are any other blackout drinkers here, but I love blackouts. I wish we could have blackouts sober. I love blackouts. There's nothing more exciting to me than leaving work on March 3rd, going back to work on March 11th, and discovering that you have been there the entire time. It's just, it makes the time between paychecks so much quicker, you know? I love blackouts, but being a blackout drinker, what it used to be like is, it has to be reported, and you just have to believe the other people are telling you the truth. I have a job today. I'm a program director for an adolescent residential treatment center in Southern California, and I had to get a fingerprint clearance for my job. I'm a really good fingerprinter. I fingerprint really, really well. I know exactly how to roll with them. I don't resist it anymore. I don't fight it. I'm really, really good at rolling with the prints. Oh, years of experience. And while I'm being printed, I don't want to raise any red flags. So I very calmly say to this woman who's printing me, how far back are you going to check? And she looked me in the eye and said, from the day you were born. I said, it's like a fifth step, only it's in the wrong order because they're going to know about it before I do. And and when my report came back, the woman called me. You know how non-alcoholics, when they're going to give us what they think is bad news, they're kind of hesitant. They got this kind of hesitancy in their voice. And she calls me back, and with that hesitancy, she says, your report came back. I said, yeah. She said, normally these reports are 2 or 3 pages. I said, uh-huh. She said, yours was 56 pages. Do you want to see it? Well, of course I did. And I can tell you I know a lot more about what it used to be like having read that report than I knew before. So, you know, this is my perception of what it used to be like. It may or may not be true. I just think it's a great story, so I'm going to tell it. I didn't have my first drink until I was 13 years old. I'm really sorry I waited that long, but I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me. As far as I know, I had never heard. I didn't have any conceptions about alcohol. I didn't make any I'll never drink promises. I had never had any I can't wait until I can drink ideas. I just never really thought much about alcohol at all. And yet when I was 13 years old, I was on a camping trip with a group of girls. We were camped on the beach just south of Oceanside. I remember getting into the tent that Friday night, and in my pillowcase was a bottle of vodka. To this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. I have always believed it was the grace of God, but I've I've not been able to verify that. But I remember taking the bottle out of the pillowcase, and I remember being excited about having it. And I asked if anybody wanted any, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, well, so what? And I took off the top and I drank half the bottle and I looked around the tent. Nothing had gotten different. Nothing had changed. So I drank the second half of the bottle. And that was to be the end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I never had resentments until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of my early resentments in Alcoholics Anonymous was I heard you talk about your first drink, and you talked about taking the drink, and you described it as it was in your mouth, and you talked about how it felt as it went down your throat, and you described it hitting your stomach, and you talked about it exploding, and it went to your fingernails and your toenails, and your pimples fell off, and you grew a couple inches, you dropped 20 pounds, you became Lady Di. I mean, wonderful things happened to you. And that was not the case for me. On my first drink of alcohol, absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me is I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief this morning that if you were to drink a quart of anything in about 15 minutes, you would have to go to the bathroom. So I got out of the tent and I shuffled down to the outhouse and I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't move. I couldn't even blink. I didn't feel my heart beating, and I was overcome with a sense of fear. And, of course, the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, I don't know how I knew this, but at 13, I intuitively knew that the body was made up of energy. And I figured if I could gather my energy, I would be all right. And I've always described it as my first formal meditation. Because I sat and I gathered my energy. And when it seemed to be in one place, when it seemed to be centrally located, I just sort of fell off the toilet, out the door, into the sand, and started crawling back to the tent. Now, of course, my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had a fantasy. I was in the Marines, I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I always have to report that my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And I've always contended under those circumstances, a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did manage somehow to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. And when I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me, and I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough that I realized I'd been sick all night long. Yeah, like you've never been sick. Ooh. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor of the tent. I hadn't missed a square inch, and quite frankly, I didn't want to be in the tent either. So I got out of there, and that was my first drink of alcohol. And it was the most wonderful, marvelous, incredible, fabulous, magnificent spiritual experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body from that day until the day I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I remember the day the guy at the market called me over and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He says, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." I got cut off from that supply. I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I still have a problem with it. If you're wearing it, I may follow you too closely. I'm often tempted when I share to introduce myself and say, "I'm Patty and I'm a pig." I'm the person that came to your house and ate and drank everything in your bathroom. I mean, and I don't know this is unusual. I don't know this is strange. I don't know that other people don't live this way. And when you think about it, how would we know? I mean, I don't know about anybody else, but I was a bar drinker. I was a sleazy bar drinker. I love sleazy bars. Nasty, nasty, sleazy bars. Sawdust on the floor. Mirrors are cracked. Kind of have to dip around to see yourself in there. Upholstery around the bars ripped where people have tried to hold on as they're falling off their bar stool. It used to be full of smoke. I know this is AA, I don't understand. In Southern California, we have these laws. You can't smoke in a bar. Now, the bars I drank in, the guys could take a leak against the wall. They can still do that, but they can't smoke. I mean, but they used to be full of smoke. They had that wonderful used booze urine smell that I salivate still. I love that smell. Sometimes if I'm in a cranky mood at work, I'll just go by one of those places, open the door, get a big hit off of that, and I'm just cracked up for the rest of the day. I love that smell. But what fascinates me is the quality of people who drank in those bars. I mean, there were CEOs of big companies. There were bank presidents, neurosurgeons, admirals in the Air Force. I mean, that's what they said they were. But we weren't sitting around having conversations like, "Well, what do you prefer, the red mouthwash or the green? What's your preference, Chantilly or Aquavelva?" We weren't having those kinds of conversations. So it doesn't occur to me I'm living any different than anybody else. I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I don't know that at 13 years old I put alcohol into an alcoholic body and from that day on I had no choice. I think I drink because I want to drink. My disease manifests itself in justification, rationalization, and denial. No matter what it is I do, I explain to you why I'm doing it. As I'm telling you, I'm hearing it. As I'm hearing it, I'm believing it. And I think I drink because I want to drink. I don't know that I don't have a choice. I had a... God, it's hot up here, is it? Is it me or... No booze is one thing, but no booze and no estrogen is quite something else. Plus, I have this hideous habit of touching myself while I'm talking. I don't know what that's about, but I like to wear silk. I think I just like the way it feels. But one time I'm talking at a meeting, and I had a lighter in my pocket, and I'm touching myself, and I'm like keeping myself cool, and I'm just like all over myself up here. And somehow, I don't know how it happened, somehow I ignited my lighter. And... And I'm wearing silk, and that boy, that stuff just takes to a flame in a minute. But I'm CPR first aid certified, so I know when you're on fire, it's stop, drop, and roll. So I ignite myself at the podium, go for the floor, but I'm also a compulsive talker, so I took the microphone with me. Rolled myself out, never missed a word of my story. Got back up, but they kept right on talking. I was a lot cooler. Most of my clothes had burned right off, but finished my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had an opportunity, so anyway, I don't know. I had an opportunity. I can't take my jacket off, though. Those of you who are looking for the easier, softer way like I do, and I always find it, I only iron the front of a shirt. So then no matter how hot you get, you got to leave the jacket on. Anyway, I had an opportunity to go to college. I'm a chronic alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis, only I don't know it's alcoholism. I just think I drink because I want to drink. Had an opportunity to go to college. I went to San Diego State. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average. I'm a chronic alcoholic. I'm drinking on a daily basis. And I graduated from college with a 3.8 grade point average. And I only share that with you because it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I got here, I told you I was too smart to be an alcoholic. Nobody with a 3.8 grade point average could possibly be an alcoholic. I was too smart to be an alcoholic. I stayed in San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I'm one of those people, if I'm doing something well, I want to keep doing it. And I seem to go to school well. I took classes for a master's degree. I left San Diego. I was offered a job in Chico, which is in Northern California. I was offered a job in Chico, and I left San Diego. I thought I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. I was a little miffed to learn later. I had another drunk driving assault charge pending. I got another resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous when I came here and found out you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault, and it had something to do with how I got out of the car. I'm also a little, I wish I drank in Oregon. I'm coming in from Portland yesterday and I see the sign, please don't drink and drive. I think, Jesus, in California it's a law. Here it's only a request. Anyway, I'm driving down the street, the red light comes on behind me, I pull over, the officer walks up to the car, the first thing I do is slam the car door open. Now, my intent is to knock him in the private parts. But men are a little fussy about their private parts, so as the door's flying open, he jumps back. And when he jumps back, it's really a good thing, because now he's far enough away that I can get him in focus. And I think, one of him, one of me. One of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I would go for him. And it'd be a really good fight for a couple of minutes, but I wouldn't remember that back at the car he had a friend. And the friend had a radio, and the friend would call some more friends. Pretty soon be three or four of them, one of me. It's not fair anymore. I say uncle, and they take me away. The next time the light comes on, I pull over. The officer walks up. I slam the car door open, try and knock him in the private parts. He jumps back to protect himself. He gets far enough away that I can get him in focus, and I think, one of him, one of me, I think I can take him. One of him, one of me, I think I'll try, and I go for him. And it's a good fight for a couple of minutes, but I forget the friend, the radio, and the friend's friends. Pretty soon, five or six of them, one of me, it's not fair anymore, I say uncle, and they take me away, and I don't do that once or twice. I did that 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. And that's the insanity of my disease. The insanity of my disease is I do the same thing over and over, and I think the results are going to be different. This time I'm going to take him. This time it's a fair fight. I never remember the friend, the radio, and the friend's friend. So, and even though they win those fights, they put an assault charge at the end of it. Drunk driving assault, drunk driving assault. I had another one of those pending. I mean, life was closing in, and as alcoholics, when life's closing in, we take off, and I was offered a job, and I took it. Loaded everything I owned into my car, took two cases of beer, two bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got to Santa Ana, which is 88 miles from where I started from. And not the place you want to shoot for. I was out of booze and I was thirsty. I pulled off the freeway. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in, it was full of smoke. It had that wonderful used booze urine smell. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got. 88 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my God, my friend, my lover, my companion, my support. And at some point, it began to strip me. I think it was in the middle of my first drink. But at some point, it began to strip me of self-esteem, self-worth, dignity, decency, integrity, honesty, pride, all the things we have going for us as human beings. And by the time I got here, it would take long before I got to you, it had taken it all. But alcohol controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from. 88 miles. That's as far as alcohol would let me go. I got a job in the profession of my choice. I rose very quickly to the top. And that, too, almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I came here, I told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I told you about the big oak desk I sat behind. I told you about the trophies and the plaques. What I didn't tell you about is in the newspaper business, and we often gave awards. And I know this morning was because God gave me a gift. We often won awards. What I didn't tell you about was the times that I would come out of a blackout, standing behind a podium much like this in a room full of people, holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And so I would say, thank you, and I would go sit down. And then they would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Kiwanis Club, and I'd have to get up and start over again. And I didn't tell you about that. I just told you I was too successful to be an alcoholic. I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of what I pray God is my last drunk driving assault. By the time, I'm also very anal. When I get released from jail, I get the arrest report and I read it. I find out where I made my mistakes so I can practice that part. So that next time I'll get that part right. And I always knew there'd be a next time. I always knew there'd be a next time. And the cops were looking for me. The cops were always looking for me. They were. I was very influential in my community. I had written some exposés that pissed them off. They were always looking for me. Rationalization, justification, and denial. Whatever it is. And I would practice field sobriety. I practice field sobriety tests a lot. I am really, really good at field sobriety tests. I mean, to this day, I can stand on 1 foot for 45 minutes. I am really good at field sobriety tests. So when I pray God as my last drunk driving assault, I was taking the field sobriety test. I was doing an excellent job. I'd have given myself an A+. In fact, I think I mentioned it to the officer. And at the end of it, he asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before, I had responded with, I can't even do that sober. And then I had just confessed, and they took me away. So on the last one, when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. And see, you think it's funny? He wasn't even amused. I'm turned around. He put the cuffs on me, took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I went to court on that charge, and I was 26 years old, and I was drunk in court, and I was being, because of my past record, I was being sentenced to 10 years in prison. The state of California was starting to get just a little upset about people barreling down their freeway at 80 miles an hour, blowing something over their grade point average on their breathalyzer. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed, the tone of his voice got different, and I know he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because in the middle of sentencing me, he looked at me and he said, I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance. And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wish I could tell you, I left the courtroom, I came here, I looked at the 12 steps. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. And if Doris, Joanne, and Tony weren't here, I would tell you that story. But that isn't my story. 26 years old, I stood in the courtroom thinking about it. Jail alternative. Jail alternative. Public defender's putting his elbow in my ribs, trying to get me to make a decision. I've been to jail. I know how to do jail. There's more alcohol and other drugs inside the institution than there are some days on the street. If you know what to do, who to do it to, and you're willing to go to any lengths, and I always was. Jail alternative. And that morning, I had what I know this morning. I didn't know what it was then, but today I know. I had a moment of clarity. Because as drunk as I was in that courtroom that morning, I knew, as clear as I'd known anything, that if I went to jail one more time, I would either die in the institution or I'd become institutionalized for life. And I didn't know why I knew it then, but I took the alternative. I left the courtroom and I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it had been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know what ANA was. I thought it was something like the PTA or Parents Without Partners, and a lot of days it is. But as far as I know, I'd never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know what you people were going to do to me or for me. My first meeting was a speaker meeting. It was probably bigger than this, and I can't tell you who talked that night, but I heard two things. I heard the answers are in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, so after the meeting, I stole the book. God knows I need to have the answers. I went home and, is your liver here? I'm really sorry. I heard somebody do that once. I've always wanted to do it. I used to wear my garage door opener so that I looked important, but now I have a telephone too. Kind of passed through the beeper stage into telephone, and when I'm feeling now, I don't know. I'm sorry. Don't take this personally, you who are on the phone. But when I'm feeling insecure, which I do sometimes, so I had this notion. Now, I don't know where I came up with it. I made it up. I make up a lot of stuff, by the way. It just pops into my head. I think it's true. And I make up stuff all the time. But I believed, without anybody telling me, I believed that if I worked the steps really, really hard with enough passion, with enough zealousness, if I really, really, really worked the steps, I would somehow skyrocket above human. I would like float up here in a little zone where I never experienced anything I judged as negative. I would never have a negative. It would just be zoo, 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 zoo. The truth for me is in working the steps, I've come into my humanness. And as a human being, I sometimes am insecure. I have self-doubt. I have anger. I have fear. I have human emotions. As a human being, I have human emotions. Duh. But sometimes the difference for me is I have you. And you take my hand and walk with me, but sometimes you're not there. Sometimes I feel... And when I'm feeling incredibly insecure, this is what I do. Not that you did it, whoever, please don't take this personally. This is what I do. I hook up with somebody and tell them, I'm going to be in an AA meeting tonight, a big one. I'm going to be in a big AA meeting tonight at 8:15. Would you call me? So that everybody knows how important I am. That's what I do when I'm insecure. Just want you to know how important I am. I'm feeling fairly secure this morning. I have it on silent. And I won't report to you how many calls I get while I'm up here talking. I arrived in AA. So I read the book. The first night, I read the whole book. I was so irritated because not only could I not find the answers, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh dear God, I've stolen the wrong book. And I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And this really irritated me. The other thing I heard in that meeting is we don't drink between meetings. Well, I looked around the room and I didn't see any of them drinking in the meeting. And I thought, if you're not drinking in the meeting and you don't drink between the meetings, when do you drink? It made me nervous. When do you drink? I could not understand why the judge sent me to a place where people didn't drink. I would have understood if he sent me to Sears School of Safe Driving. I did not understand why he sent me to a place where people didn't drink. And I was going to go back and tell him, you've made a hideous error. But before I go back, I better get that answer book. So Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's where I met Joanne, and that's where I met Doris, and that's where I met Tony. 4 days, and Joanne thought that was my first meeting. I said, oh, no, I was well into my recovery by the time I met you. It was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room. I could not figure out what it was you had that was so hot that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you have nice cars. I have a record for Grand Theft Auto. I know how to get those. Some of you have nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. Some of you have nice spouses. We all know how to get those. We We don't keep them well, but we know how to get them. I couldn't figure out what it was you had, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. This guy was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants, not like the kids do today. I work with teenagers. I work with kids who wear pants that have absolutely no relationship to their body size. I work with kids. They could put a homeless family in their pants with them. I'm forever telling them, if the building starts on fire, you're getting out, your pants or not. I mean, his weren't that baggy, but they were baggy. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been, and he nodded out during the meeting. And I quickly assessed the situation. This man's shooting heroin. I could probably not drink if I could shoot a little heroin. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I went down to his office, and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. It's out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book and talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I'll guarantee you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my job life would get better, my relationships would get better, my finances would get better, my family life would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. It's a little hope for the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here this morning, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. See, I don't know good from bad for me. I'm going to do something I think is good for me, and it generally turns out to be bad for me. And I'm going to do something I think is bad for me, and it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me, but I know different. And every area of my life is different than it was the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And life is sometimes painful. Life sometimes unfolds in ways that I just judge as really negative. Life sometimes is very painful. And I'm very dramatic, so I always refer to it as the dark night of the soul. Unless, of course, you're going through it, and then I just tell you to get over yourself. But but in those times, if I don't drink and don't die and don't drink and don't die, I've gotten far enough beyond it to, in retrospect, be able to look back and see that every time I thought my life was falling apart, what was really happening is it was falling together. And it had to be exactly that way for God to move me to where He'd have me be. See, I dig a rut, I get comfortable. I get comfortable where I am, I decorate, I'm just happy as a little pig in shit. There's a God that has a plan for me beyond my wildest imagination. And I don't get to stay stuck in my comfort. God has this magnificent plan for me, so sometimes I just have to be bumped into the next dimension, and sometimes that's painful. But everything had to be exactly the way it was for God to move me to where I am, and I have never had it so good. Never had it. And left to my own devices, I'd have shortchanged myself. All I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. If I'd have had it my way, I'd have shortchanged myself. Growing up, now I don't know if this is true or not. Growing up, who pays attention to growing up? We're just lucky we did it. But my perception, growing up, people hurt me all the time. People disappointed me. They let me down. My parents told me they loved me. Any more of their love and I'd have died. Their love was mentally, emotionally, and physically abusive. People said they'd do it. They disappointed you. As a small child, I remember, I don't want to be hurt anymore. As a small child, I begin to build a brick wall between me and you because I just don't want to be hurt anymore. And that brick wall kept you out. What I never knew about that brick wall is it made me a prisoner inside. I lived behind that brick wall in isolation and loneliness. And alcohol didn't allow me to come out and play. Alcohol just made it okay for me to be back there. But when you live behind a wall like that, you don't believe and you don't trust. For some reason, I believed that old man that morning. I didn't know why then, but I know why this morning. The music of Alcoholics Anonymous. One alcoholic talking to another. One alcoholic talking to another breaks through that wall. It doesn't matter how thick that wall is. I hadn't believed a human being in a long, long time, but I believed him. I went home and I did the things he told me to do. I already had the books. Every night I'd open to chapter 3 and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. I'd say amen and close the book, and that was reading the book. I would go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where they have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager. He'd say, "Hi, Patty." That was talking to another alcoholic. My court program said I had to go to 2 meetings a week. I thought that was really obsessive. But I was willing to go to any lengths to stay out of jail. So I went to the 2 meetings a week my court program said I had to go to. And the only thing I did right is I didn't drink. And I didn't drink, and I didn't drink, and I didn't drink. And I was not a kind and loving newcomer. I was angry. And I acted out in violence. And I was hostile in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd be at a speaker meeting, and the speaker would be sharing. I'd get irritated. I'd jump up from the back of the room. I'd tell them exactly what I thought about them. It was usually just profanities, but I hung it together in such a way that it sounded like a sentence. And I would just spew it out. And then some little blue-haired lady would turn around in front of me and say, "Keep coming back." And I'd flip her off, and I'd wave my court card in her face and tell her I didn't have a choice, and I'd sit back down until I went off again. I loved to go to meetings at the Canyon Club because we had these long tables, and somebody would irritate me. I'd stand up. If you take the table, you can impact about 20 people at one time. And I just take the table with me, and people would come up to me, because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. People would come up to me and try and talk to me, and I'd kick at you, and I'd spit at you, and I'd swing at you, and I'd throw my coffee. And this isn't the bedrock of mental health, but eventually people weren't coming up to me anymore. Unless, of course, your sponsor was irritated with you. If your sponsor was irritated with you, he or she would point to me and say, "See that lady over there? Go give her your number." So being a good alcoholic, and I would go off. And thank God the people in Alcoholics understood Anonymous understood the traditions, because he never threw me away. I remember one time I heard the traditions read. Now, I know now they're read at every meeting, but I didn't know then. I was way too busy. And the third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I was so excited, I leapt out of my chair. That's it. I don't have a desire to stop drinking. I want to drink more than I want to breathe. I can't stay here. And on my way out, Joe Quinn, an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous, grabbed me. He said, "Patty, there's a judge in South Orange County Court. He has a desire for you to stop drinking." And in your case, we're going to let that be enough. I stayed on somebody else's desire. I don't think it matters whose desire you're here on. I think what matters is that you don't take a drink. I don't think it matters your desire, your intention, your motive. I think what's important is you don't take a drink. And I didn't take a drink, and I didn't take a drink, and I didn't take a drink. 8.5 months away from my last drink, I was in a pain that I have not been in before or since. The pain of not drinking and not recovering. The pain of not drinking and not recovering is the greatest pain I have ever been in. And 8.5 months away from my last drink, that pain drove me to my knees. And on my knees, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol. That whenever I ingest alcohol, I lose. When I drink alcohol, I'm damned to live the same way day after day after day after day. If I don't like the way I live today, if I don't drink, I can choose to live differently tomorrow. But when I drink alcohol, I don't have that choice. I'm damned to live the same way day after day after day after day. And alcohol controls every area of my life. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. How many of you have gotten into the ring with alcohol with the newcomer? And you're giving them direction, and yeah, but do-do-do-do-do-do. And you give them the same direction, yeah, but do-do-do-do-do-do. And you give them the direction, yeah, but do-do-do-do-do-do. And you give them the direction, yeah, but do-do-do. You're in the ring with alcohol, you're going to lose. Absolutely, whenever I'm in the ring with alcohol, I lose. And that was the first step of recovery for me. And it took 8.5 months away from my last drink to get far enough away to see the evidence. You all saw it when I came in. You gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it. Until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. I wish I could tell you then that I worked the steps quickly and skyrocketed to recovery. The truth for me, I have never worked any of the steps till my back was against the wall. The pain was so great it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. Under those circumstances, I become very willing to work the next one of the 12 steps to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. As long as I have a good idea, as long as I have yet another plan, I'm going to implement that before I work the step. Every good idea, every plan I have to run out of good ideas and I have to run out of plans before I'm willing to look at the next step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet when I work the step, I come to you, I'm so excited that I've surrendered. I'm just like, I made this up. Oh, golly gee. And you all tolerate it. You nod your head. And you understand, because you've all been in the exact same place. As long as you have a plan or a good idea, you're not going to work the steps. And this is just my experience with the steps. For me, there is no way to get from where I was on October 4th, 1975, to where I am today, except through the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery, for me. For me, the 12 steps are not suggested. For me, Alcoholics Anonymous is a suggested way to recover from alcoholism. The book talks about there are other ways to get sober. Alcoholics Anonymous is a suggested way to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, but if I choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I am required to work the 12 steps exactly the way they're written in the book. I am required to do that. And this is my experience. Step two for me, I'm a loner by nature. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change your nature. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me is it's given me the courage and strength to do the things I need to do in spite of my nature. But it doesn't change my nature. I'm a loner by nature. The book talks about we become disgustingly, even dangerously antisocial. I didn't become that way, started out that way. I have developed one social skill. I've used it already this morning, so I'm like fresh out. The most difficult thing for me to do is to come and be with you. My preference is to sit on my couch. My preference is to be by myself. My preference is to do things alone. I'm a loner, but you know you're a loner if you don't like AA potlucks. That's generally the indicator. But so for me, and I have one problem with God. I believe we are all God's children, and I have always wanted to be an only child. And that's the only problem I have with God. But for me, the power greater than myself in step two was not God. You see, as a loner, if I had come to believe that God was going to restore me to sanity, I'd have sat on my couch. God would have flown in, sprinkled me with sanity, taken off to wherever it is God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. I would be on my couch this morning watching the Cooking Channel, and somebody else would be here sharing with you. For me, the power greater than myself was the action of steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I came to believe that through taking the action of the steps, I would be restored to right thinking. I have alcoholism. I don't have alcoholism. I will always be an alcoholic. As a result of the steps, I don't suffer from alcoholism. I simply have alcoholism. Step three for me, I hear people all the time, they say, well, what step are you on? Well, I'm on the third step. Every morning I get up and turn my will and my life over the care of God, but by about noon I take it back. Well, I'm on the third step, you know, I'm turning my will and my life over the care of God, except for my sex and finances, because I don't want to be poor and celibate. And I pretty much stay away from those people, because I don't think they understand the step. I go the same way to work every day. I'm driving up Chapman Avenue in Orange. I'm coming to the corner of the intersection at Schaefer. I have to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right and make a decision to turn right, and I go straight through the intersection. To make a U-turn, I'm going back to that intersection. I got to make a decision, turn right, turn left, or go straight. Now to get to my job, I got to turn left and make a decision to turn left, and I go straight through the intersection. I make another U-turn, and I'm getting really irritated, and I'm headed back toward the intersection to make a decision, turn right, turn left, to go straight. To get to my job, I got to turn right and make a decision to turn right, and go straight through the intersection. Now I am really irritated. I make yet another U-turn with an F-word thrown in there, and I'm headed back toward the intersection. Make a decision, turn right, turn left, to go straight. I make a decision to turn left. I take the steering wheel, and I do this. And the book talks about it. It says, in essence, although our decision was vital, it had very little permanent effect unless immediately followed by action. The decision I make to turn right or left has no impact on my car. What has an impact on my car is turning the steering wheel, is taking an action. The decision in step three has no impact. Here's a decision. How do you want to live? Chronic, helpless alcoholic, or do you want to believe the people in AA are telling you the truth? Incomprehensible demoralization? Hope. Despair? Hope. It's not a difficult decision. I think I'll go with hope. But it has no impact unless I do something. And the something I had to do was a fourth step. And I wrote the fourth step the way the book says to do it. I made the columns, wrote down everybody I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. What they did to me. Well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they've done to me. How it affected me. It affected my self-esteem, my self-worth. No wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you, you'd have drank too. And then in my zealousness, I accidentally turned the page of the big book. And hidden in the copy of the text, hidden, it says, referring to our list again, we put out of our minds the wrongs others had done, and we looked at our part. Well, took the fun right out of it. But I did that. I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And for the first time, I saw who Patio really was. See, justification, rationalization, and denial. I put on a show for you. I saw the show, and I believed it. I didn't have a clue. Until I did my fourth step, I saw who I really was. Then I looked at step five and thought it was really very clever. For those of you who aren't Catholic, probably need to talk to somebody about this stuff. So, because we know about confession, and we know it doesn't work. And the rest of you could have the same experience we have. So I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car because I didn't want anybody to find it, and drove around with a sense of impending doom. And, of course, the fear always was as I'd be rear-ended on the freeway. My trunk would fly open. My fourth step would be everywhere. But one night I was visiting a friend of mine in Los Angeles, or a woman I knew in Los Angeles, and we were talking. As we were talking, I realized I was doing a fifth step. And I thought, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. I went to my car and I got my fourth step and I did my fifth step with her. And when I finished, she looked at me and she said, Patty, someday the things you have listed as your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things you have listed as your greatest liabilities will become your greatest assets. And I thought, oh, wonderful. I have just done a fifth step with a woman who has lost her last wingnut. I need to tell you the things I have always thought were my greatest assets in Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest liabilities. I'm a strong woman. I've always been a strong woman. That strength has always been an asset for me. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it becomes a liability. Because whenever I try to do anything by myself, I shortchange myself. When I put my hand out and ask one of you to walk with me, you open new doors and you add to my life. And that thing that was always an asset becomes a liability in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that has happened in every area of my life. I went home from doing my fifth step. I did step six and seven by mistake. I didn't mean to recover this quickly, but... And although I'm talking to you very quickly about all this, I want you to know we are a couple, 3 years sober by now. I went home and, but just by coincidence, I opened the book to the part where it talks about step six and seven. You don't have to be a journalist to know the book Alcoholics Anonymous is very poorly written. Any newcomer will tell you. And but that part around step six and seven gets kind of poetic, and I got kind of lulled into reading it. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven-step prayer. When I became aware of what I was reading, that prayer took the longest journey anything has ever taken for me, the journey from my head to my heart. And I knew I believed it. And I finished reading that book and that prayer, and what it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I've been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. And I believe that's the miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous. The miracle here is we have an opportunity to walk away from the person we've been all of our life to start to become the person God intended for us to be. And I'm afraid too many people leave before they give themselves that chance. Too many people leave before they have the opportunity to find out who it is God intended for them to be. The best I've ever described myself when I came here was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you've been willing to share with me, I've become very kind, very loving, very nurturing, very caring. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but... I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. Steps 8 and 9 for me were conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I felt guilty because I was guilty. I did a lot of things to a lot of people for one more drink. I felt guilty because I was guilty. The great controversy in Southern California periodically is, where do you put yourself on the list? I hear people talking about putting themselves first on the eight-step list. I want you to know if I put myself first, I would never get to number two. Selfish and self-centered, it's the root of my disease. I don't belong on that list. I may have made some unhealthy choices. I may have done some stupid things. But everything I did for me. Everything I did for me. And the amends were about getting right with you. The amends were about getting right with my family, about getting right with society, about getting right with the courts, about getting right with you. That's the amends had nothing to do with me. The amends were about getting right with you. And I became willing to make amends to everybody but my father. I hate my father. My father's a Jekyll and Hyde drunk. I was the target of my father's abuse, and I hate him, and I'm not making amends to him. And my sponsor told me that was fine. She said, as long as you're willing to pay the price. I said, absolutely. I don't want to go to the father-daughter banquet. I'm willing to... What possible price? Of course I'm willing. And I began to make amends and get right with you, and I don't know how to do it. But the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous would share how they lived their life. You would share how you were a good employee and how you didn't drink, and how you were a good daughter and you didn't drink, and how you were a good wife and you didn't drink, and how you were a good aunt and you didn't drink. And I would go out and do the things I heard you talk about and not drink. And I would come back and report. And I would listen to somebody else. And I would go out and try it. You never told me what to do. You always told me what you had done. And I would go out and try it. You have never in Alcoholics Anonymous told me what to do. You have told me what you have done. I think the biggest commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous is coffee maker. I think it's the most important job you can have. Way more important than secretary or leader or chairperson. Way more important. Biggest commitment you can have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was made coffee person one time for a meeting. And they gave me this coffee pot that was like this big. Now, I live alone. I don't know about you. What the hell is that? And they gave me a big can of coffee. Now, I can't say to you, I don't know how. Because I know everything. I have made it clear that I know everything. So the next week, I come with my huge coffee pot, my big can of coffee, and I put water in it, and I'm thinking, can of coffee. Pour it in the coffee pot. Plug it in. People start coming to the meeting, pour their coffee. Take a drink. Their eyeballs roll back in their head. So somebody else takes a drink. They just start, you know, thinking, Jesus, you're 20 years sober. What, you're going to have a seizure on me? I mean, nobody says this is hideous coffee. This is the worst coffee. Hang that coffee maker. Throw that. Nobody says anything. They don't drink a lot of coffee, but they don't say anything. At the end of the meeting, the secretaries make an announcement, as we do, and the secretary says, you know, we had a steering committee meeting. I thought, when did they do that? We had a steering committee meeting, and we have realized coffee is the most important job in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is a huge responsibility. So we're going to assign an assistant coffee maker. And they assigned me an assistant. And I am a program director. I am good at delegating. So the next week we show up with our huge coffee and our huge can, and I delegate to my assistant to make the coffee. And I stood back and I watched. And he showed me how to make coffee in Alcoholics Anonymous. He didn't say, you are a stupid woman. Don't you know how to do this? Were you born in a barn? Are you a retard? He showed me how to make coffee. And that is what you have done for me for 27 years. You have shown me how to live out there without taking a drink. You have never told me what to do. And I got right with people in my life. And as a result of steps 8 and 9, I began to nod out meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of steps 8 and 9, I understood that old man who, by the way, had been sober longer than I'd been alive, which shows you what my judge of people was like. The reason he nodded out in meetings is he had something inside. He had a serenity and a peace. He was right inside. He was right with himself. He was right with us, and he was right with God. And he nodded, and that's what allowed him to nod out in meetings. And as a result of making amends, I became able to nod out in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All of a sudden, now I'm 4 or 5 years sober, and I start looking around Alcoholics Anonymous. And I notice that people are like gathered together before the meeting, gathered together after the meeting. Now, I don't want friends. I have never wanted friends. Friends are a nuisance. Friends call you up and you see them and they go, where were you last night? I called you up. This is before answering machines. I know there are people in here that are so young you don't even know there was a time before answering machines. I called you last night. Where were you? Well, if I wanted you to know where I was, I would have told you before I went. People in your life are really a nuisance. They bother you and they always want something. I don't want that. But suddenly I'm 3 or 4 or 5 years sober and I start noticing people in AA are like doing more than just coming to the meeting. They're talking about coffee and going to movies and dinner and hanging. People are having friendships in alcohol and I think I want some. Now, I don't know how to be a friend. I'm not going to ask. But this is how I make friends. I sit next to somebody in a meeting. The next meeting, I sit next to the same person. By about the third time, you are now my friend. Now I have a friend because we always sit together in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. But then my friend will do something to annoy me, like crack her gum, kick me as she's crossing her legs, go get herself coffee and not see if I want any. Now you can't be my friend anymore. So now I have to sit next to somebody else for two or three meetings. Now I have a new friend. Until that friend irritates me, breathes too hard, cracks her gum, it's a big one. Then you can't be my friend, now I need a new friend. And there are a lot of people in AA, you can do this for a really long time. I'm like switching up friends every fourth or fifth meeting. And then one time I'm talking to my sponsor. Now you have to be very careful when you're talking to your sponsor. It's best to take notes so that you don't get diverted off into something else by mistake. But in a conversation with my sponsor, I accidentally complain about the fact that people in AA don't know how to be friends. I'm trying to have friends and they're irritating me. They're kicking me. They're irritating me. And I'm off onto something else, and my sponsor says, wait a minute, come back to the friend thing. Well, come back to the friend thing. She says, you know, remember you wouldn't make amends to your father? Well, yeah. She said, Patty, hate doesn't know that it's directed at one person. Hate doesn't know that it just stays there. Hate will spread out into every relationship you try to have. I became willing to make amends to my father, not because I wanted to go to the father-daughter potluck. I became willing to make amends to my father because I wanted to have friendships with you. It doesn't matter what your motive is or what your intention is. The only thing that matters is what your action is, as long as the action is right. And I made amends with my father, and it was a long process, but I was right with my father when he died. And I had the ability, the day before he died, I spent a couple, half an hour maybe with him. My brothers and sisters had been with him the whole weekend before, and he was pretty much not responding to them. And the half hour that I spent with my father, he laughed. And when I left, I kissed him on the cheek, and I told him I loved him, and I didn't know that I was going to tell him that. I didn't know that I loved him. But through the power of the ninth step, I was right with my father. And that night he passed away. And I was able to share my last visit with him, with my brothers and sisters, because they hadn't had the same experience on their last visit. We share with one another, not just members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We share experience, strength, and hope with one another. And as a result, I began to have friends. I began to make friendships in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my very best friend, we are people who normally would not mix. My very best friend and I don't even know how we started to be friends, because we shouldn't have even talked to one another. This woman thinks self-supporting through your own contribution is alimony. I think it's working 10, 12 hours a day. She went and took a battery of tests to find out what she should be when she grows up. Literally, the test said, you should be royalty on a very small island. So I began calling her the princess. She, in turn, began calling me the medicine woman. We are people who normally would not mix. She went to jail and cried. I went to jail and fought. We went on a couple vacations together. I take a duffel bag. She has to go in and out of her house 17 times to bring, because she has to have adequate costume changes. We are people who normally would not mix. My favorite piece of literature next to the big book is A Member's Eye View. And there's a line in A Member's Eye View that says something to the essence of, that the primary search of every man and woman from cradle to grave is to find another human being before whom he can stand, stripped of all pretense and defense, and trust that that person won't hurt him, because that person has stripped himself too. And my friend the princess was that person in my life. Absolutely the person in my life that I could anything. And we disagreed. I mean, we have to disagree. We are so polar opposites. She had a very good story. She only went out of state once to tell it. She wouldn't go again because she couldn't take enough luggage on the airplane. And so we disagreed, but we never ended a day without being right with each other. We were always right with each other. And the reason, the bond of our friendship, was the passion that we both share for Alcoholics Anonymous. The bond of our relationship is a passion we share for the things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on September, my friend the princess had breast cancer about 9 years ago, and she's a breast cancer survivor. She had a double mastectomy, and she survived breast cancer 9 years ago through the power and the strength of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And on September 1st, 2001, she was diagnosed with breast cancer in the liver. And on October 27th of that year, she died. And I didn't know if I was going to survive. Because I'm the person that just doesn't want to be hurt anymore. And I so badly wanted to put that wall back up between me and you. I was in such pain, and it was my loss. It was my loss. But it was so painful to me, and it's still very painful to me. But it was so painful to me that I didn't think I was going to survive. And I had learned in 25 years that I'd been sober, my feet knew the right actions. My feet knew to go to meetings no matter what the rest of me said and wanted to do. I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in such pain. But I would come sit with you, and when they would read Chapter 5, rarely have we seen a person fail, I would come into the room. For the hour and a half I was with you, I knew I was going to be okay. And I just, one day at a time, one minute at a time, didn't put that first brick in the wall. Because I just didn't want to be hurt anymore. And I was in such pain. And an Al-Anon told me, and God bless her, an Al-Anon said to me, you know, the pain that you feel is equivalent to the joy that you've experienced in the last 18 years of your friendship with Cindy. The pain that you feel is equivalent to the joy. Would you have denied yourself the joy? Would God have denied you the joy of the last 18 years? And with that piece of information, I was able a day at a time to move forward. But I still am suffering emotionally from the loss. There are times that I reach for the telephone because Cindy would want to know about this. I broke down in an airport in Mobile, Alabama, because we used to buy each other the stupidest things. If it was hideous, I bought it. She had a boyfriend who got, he's just a nice, nice man, but he put fucking happy faces on everything. I would go over to her house. I knew he'd been there. There were happy faces everywhere. So I just started buying hideous happy faces and sending them to her anonymously. Is it me or him? You know, I mean, if it was stupid, I bought it. I mean, we were just beyond retarded. But I was in Mobile, Alabama, about a month and a half after she died. And I was in the gift shop, and they had a pencil that had a lust voodoo doll on it. And I said to myself, the princess would like this. And I reached for it, and I remembered she was gone. And I decompensated in the gift shop in the airport in Mobile, Alabama. And a group of people who are not alcoholic, a group of people were there, and they walked with me through that, and they stayed with me until I was okay. One human being talking to another. One human being sharing with another. And the reason I was able to accept their sharing was because of my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because having been with you, you have allowed me to open up, not just to alcoholics, but to the world. You have allowed me to open up to the resources that are in the world. You have allowed me to open up to everything it is that God has to give me and put me in a position where I can accept it. And so, you know, and so we move forward. And we miss Cindy a lot in our area. We miss her a lot. And I probably miss her most of all. I don't know if I miss her most of all, but I miss her a lot. But I carry with me the passion that she shared for Alcoholics Anonymous. I carry that with me. And I would not have denied myself the 18 years of friendship that we had. Steps 10, 11, and 12 are the steps that allow me to continue to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. 10 says the process is powerful. Keep using it. Keep writing about it, talking about it. Ask God to remove the defect, make amends if necessary, and then turn your attention to somebody you can help. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? It seems to me when I'm focused on my problem, God can't do a thing with it. But when my attention's on you, God can come in and take care of my stuff. What is it I can do for you? How can I be of service? Step 11, I'm a very simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. And I'm so naive, I truly believe the rest of the day is God's business. My prayer at night is a little scarier. Offer it to anybody who'd like to use it. My prayer at night is, dear God, please have people treat me tomorrow exactly the way I treated people today. And when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, when I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight, it will hold me in good stead. I don't live my life so much out of virtue as I do that I know I'm going to say that prayer tonight. And the folks who were next to me in the hotel should be grateful that I'm going to say that prayer tonight, because I was really irritated with you about 11:30. I don't live my life so much out of virtue as I do out of the fact that I know I'm going to say that prayer. And if you're brave enough, start using that prayer and it will change your life. It keeps me from flipping people off on the freeway. I still count, but I don't announce to everybody behind me how many items the guy in the 10-item or less line in front of me has in his basket. And step 12 is the greatest gift you've ever given me, the opportunity to take a little of my past, to give it to another alcoholic, to look her in the eye and say, honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Take my hand, come with me, sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. A day at a time, you don't have to live that way anymore. It's the greatest gift you've ever given me. I want to tell you that my home group is a women's meeting on Thursday night at the Canyon Club. It's a meeting we started for women who hated women's meetings. I think Doris and Joanne both went to the other women's meeting where they... I was sharing one time, I used the F word, and I just wanted a reaction. This woman reacted, so I used it about 20 more times in 60 seconds. After the meeting, they came up to me and told me they didn't want me to come back until I could learn how to talk like a lady. And I hadn't wanted to be there in the first damn place, so... But I made a mistake and mentioned it to my sponsor. Don't do that. That's, like, bad. And she told me that I needed to learn how to talk. I said, well, how do I do that? She said, hang around with the women. I don't like them. So we started this meeting for women who hate women's meetings. You were required to use the F word when you shared. You couldn't knit. No knitters allowed. And that's been my home group. It's a very, very sick meeting. I go there because I look healthy. And Patty Hayes is a regular member of that group, and I'm so grateful that Patty's here this weekend with us. Patty's a regular member of that group. We have a small body of real regular women, and then we have at least 20 newcomers every Thursday who are there. It's a fabulous meeting. If you're ever in Laguna Beach at 6 o'clock on a Thursday night, please come to the Canyon Club and join us. I'm going to end. I hate to end. I told you I was a compulsive talker, but I have a plane to catch in Portland. And I only have a 50-minute bladder. I'm about 10 minutes over my... I'm going to end with this story, though, because it puts it all together for me. And it's a story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room. It says hell on the outside. But when they open the door, they look inside. It's a huge banquet. Tables and tables and tables of food, any kind of food you'd ever imagine, any kind of food you'd ever want. The people in that room are hungry. They're starving and they're dying. And the reason they're hungry is they have, you know, those long wooden spoons that people who cook tied to their arms, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. And so they were sitting amongst plenty, and they were starving. And that's how I was before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. They took them to a room marked heaven, and that room was the same scene. It was a banquet, tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine. And the people in that room had those spoons tied to their hands, too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long. They couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the difference was is that one woman was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person across the table. And she was taking a spoonful and feeding somebody else, and he was feeding the person next to him. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here, and I have to let you feed me. And every once in a while, if I'm lucky, I get to give a spoonful of this thing to another alcoholic. And you don't have to have 27 years or 20 years or 10 years or 5 years. If you got one day, you have something to feed to the man or woman coming through the door. If you have one day, you have something to give to the person sitting next to you. It takes a lot of courage and a lot of strength to continue to choose to recover. I don't have it. But I come here, and when we pray, the person on my right will give me a little courage. The person on my left will give me a little strength. And you give me the courage and strength I need to continue to choose to recover. And if you have one day, you have courage to give to the person on your right, and you have strength to give to the person on your left. We can do what I can. Of myself, I'm nothing. I need you more this morning than I needed you when I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I need your courage and I need your strength. When I was 4 days sober, an old man told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different, and he didn't lie to me. And I end with this because it's been my experience, and I pray, God, it's your experience. It's a line we heard when Patty read chapter 5, the line that says, there is one who has all power, That one is God. May you find him now. Thank you.